Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. Fabric Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Microsoft Fabric, a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 7 with guest Philip Seamark. Welcome. Our guest today is Philip Seamark, who's also from Down Under, but across the ditch in New Zealand. Phil is a member of the Fabric Customer Advisory Team and works as a DAX and Data Modeling Specialist and gets involved when enterprise customers need deeper technical support. So welcome, Phil.
Hey, Greg, and thanks for inviting me along.
No, too cool. It's good to get some near locals on the show. That's excellent. Hey, so listen, tell us a little bit about your role.
Yeah, sure. So obviously I work as part of the Fabric engineering team, the product group that build Fabric, in particular in a very specialist group called the customer advisory team. Now, we tend to sit 1 foot in the customer camp and 1 foot in the engineering camp and help act as a conduit to collect feedback and sort of translate that to the engineers who build Fabric, so they fully understand exactly what problems customers are trying to solve with various tools like Power BI and now Fabric. Yeah. I kind of think of us more as advocates quite often for our large customers, just to really get involved with them, see firsthand what they'd like to be able to do with our tools, so that we can then translate that, as I mentioned, to the key people in the engineering group who build the product, that we make sure we build it that way. And that's been something that's been important right from day one with Power BI. And I think it's been a big factor in the success of Power BI is simply the fact that the senior leadership prioritized and put a lot of emphasis on listening to customers, and not just not just enterprise customers, but also through user voice and those channels as well, to make sure we actually build what people need and want. And so my role, you know, the CAT team very much continues that today.
So the Power BI CAT team pretty much morphed into the Fabric CAT team?
That's right. Yes. Yes. So as Fabric has come along and it's grown in terms of a landscape, a lot of what has succeeded, or the reasons for the success of Power BI, have been inherited and borrowed and brought into Fabric.
How much you mentioned the user voice and the feedback channels? How effective do you think that is? Because one of the issues that we've sort of come across in the past with, let's say, in the SQL Server territory and things like that, is that it's so few people tend to interact with that that I often think it's very hard when they sort of like judge the popularity of an issue based upon what appears there. Because I find two things. One is that a lot of people, when they visit there, tend to only be interested in their own thing. It's not like they sort of cruise the place all the time looking for things to vote on. And often there'll be things that people post that are quite thoughtful, but don't yet affect everybody. And, you know, and I'm just sort of wondering, you know, how do those things ever bubble up far enough to be of interest?
Oh, totally. There is that risk. And that's where teams like CAT can get involved and hopefully identify and recognize something that perhaps won't get enough visibility through the user voice world, but equally through the enterprise feedback channels. And when I think back to various PMs, when they are deciding where they should invest money to build the product, usually the breakdown is perhaps 40% of that gets influenced by the user voice channels, you know, votes there. Yeah. 40% usually come from the direct feedback through conversations with large enterprise customers. And there's usually a bit of a 20% leeway for our senior leadership who are listening talking, trying to gauge strategy and direction, that they can have an impact as well. But you're right, an absolutely gem of an idea can get lost in user voice. There's no question there. But, you know, just community channels, you know, we've got our feet on the ground and talked to a lot of people.
Yeah, one of the things is that people assume that Microsoft has like infinite resources to build whatever's needed, and clearly that's not the case. Like any company, I mean, decisions have to be made about what makes sense. One of the things I used to find with other channels, though, is that they had periods where you'd have a discussion where you say, this would be an excellent thing, and a bunch of people say it, but then they go, well, tell me how many more licenses we would sell if we did that one thing. And you just go, oh, there's no way I could discuss that. But I found previously the Power BI team tended to be a lot more responsive than many of the others in terms of taking up things that just made sense, you know, along the way.
Yeah, although there will still be the element of, look, you know, if this feature can, is there any way that we can see what the adoption impact of this feature might be, is still very important. And we look at that very closely. How many more people are using Power BI today than were using it last month or the same month last year? So anything we do to Power BI or now Fabric, it's not cheap. It is expensive when you consider the time it takes to plan it out, develop it, test it, document it, you know, manage it through the release process.
There's so much. Like people don't even think about, you know, all the different languages that things need to work in and so on. I mean, their testing cycles for any of these things are enormous.
Yeah, and we won't get it right every single time either. The goal is that we get it right more often than we get it wrong in terms of adding functionality, because there's no doubt being things that we've spent a lot of time and money on adding that perhaps haven't been used. Now, that's not ideal. Yeah. What we want to be able to do is, as I said, spend that finite resource on making sure that we add to the product what a lot of people are going to benefit from. And unfortunately, that does mean also that sometimes edge cases where people, you know, would dearly love a certain feature, but it's just not going to get used by a lot of people.
Just not going to happen.
Perhaps that needs to go into the clever workaround. But of course, we have the ecosystem such as custom visuals, custom this, custom that, that often there is a way to do it. It just might not necessarily be in the native product.
And look, extensibility is actually one of my favorite things. And it's an area that Power BI has had pretty much from the start, actually, all sorts of thoughts around extensibility, where a lot of the other products tend to, I don't think they build an ecosystem around them, where Power BI has built quite an ecosystem around the product. And so, yeah, it'd be great to see that sort of continue into Fabric. But the thing I wanted to talk to you about today was DirectLake. We had a show early on where with Josh, where we looked at OneLake and basic storage of how things would happen in Fabric and the basic idea of Delta and Parquet files and so on. But the idea of using this as the storage for a semantic model and so on was kind of novel. So tell us the story.
Well, the irony is we've actually been using this format for quite some time. So the tabular version of Analysis Services sort of first appeared, I think, around 2009. In Excel was one of the early versions of.
Yeah.
This is an in-memory data. And what we did at that point was organize data into columns as opposed to rows. Mm-hmm. And it's not too dissimilar in its anatomy to what a Parquet file might look like today.
Because they're basically column compression anyway.
Correct. So in our conversations around Fabric and the original designs, when the concept of being able to separate storage from compute sort of developed as a core tenet of the appeal of Fabric and the decision around, okay, well, what would that separate storage look like? And Delta and the underlying Parquet files being so similar to what we need when data is laid out in memory inside the the Power BI data set or semantic model, whatever we're calling it this week, it actually made it quite easy to sort of put together some prototypes and do some testing to say, well, hypothetically, you know, if we introduce this new storage mode, Direct Lake, how quickly could we page data into memory? And I remember spending time in Redmond prior to COVID, and you know, one of the engineers who was working on a very early prototype of Direct Lake was showing me, hey, you know, I've got this 50 gig of data, watch me effectively page it into memory in seconds. I was just blown away. I was just like, how can this happen? This is just, surely this is magic. But you know, the more I looked into it and the pennies were dropping in for me, I was like, actually, no, if the data is sitting on very fast SSD disk, premium file storage, etc., and we don't have to do too much to it, then that's pretty exciting. I mean, we still have to do a little bit to it, but
What was the driver for wanting it on storage rather than in memory in the first place?
Well, I think this whole concept with Fabric being able to separate the storage from compute layer, for all the compute from layers compute. In Fabric. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you know with SQL and a lot of the compute engines, some are proprietary, some are open. The proprietary ones, well, you know, if you want to be able to get at the data inside a SQL database, you sort of have to jump through some hoops to export them out. So, so being able to separate that for Kusto, Spark, SQL, and Power BI, and have them all talking the same language, being able to at least read, but also potentially write to that same.
Yeah, having that common across a lot is a really interesting thing. The because I know certainly when you're talking about separating compute and storage, that was like a big thing pushed by, say, people like Snowflake and people like that, in just in the core design of how they did things. And one of the things that always sort of fascinated me with Snowflake is they tend to heavily worry about ingestion speed and less about what you do with it once it gets there. But anyway, that's a topic for another show, but something like that. So how usable, though, in terms of the storage itself, I think one of the drivers seems to be to minimize the number of copies of data that's held. How do you think that fits with the semantic model? Because I'm just thinking that, you know, I endlessly see examples where people take source systems now and they sort of import the stuff into a Delta Lake and then they sort of immediately have a semantic model built over that. And it's the most horrible looking semantic model you've ever seen, because it's just built over those semantic, you know, those tables that were dragged into the Direct Lake or the Data Lake and or the Lake House, you know. And I still end up feeling like I need more copies of the data anyway.
Yeah, well, when we were designing Fabric, we talked to a lot of customers, and a big common theme that we picked up was, you know, we don't like the idea of making duplicate copies, many, many copies of our data, because we have to manage code to be able to move the data throughout. So the simpler you can get that, the fewer of those steps, the better. Now, you can't realistically eliminate it down to just one. And a common pattern you see in a lot of ETL frameworks around the place might be, more recently, sort of a bronze, silver, gold set of layers.
Yeah, the medallion architectures in the sort of Lake House.
And in my day,
Databricks.
You know, 20 years ago, we used to call this load, stage, and persist. It's sort of different jargon for the same thing, where just get the raw data in and make sure you have as few errors as possible. So just don't care, just get the data in and then we'll clean it up.
100% agree. If we're doing a data warehouse in a SQL Server database, I always have a staging area, and my main aim is bring it in without it falling over while it's coming in. So if there are issues and things, I'll deal with it once it's over here. Another big part of that, though, is also trying to make sure I only have one copy of everything that's come. And the third one is to try and have the least impact possible on that source system, too, where a lot of people I see trying to do transformations on the way out of those source systems. And the problem with that is you can often end up having a horrid impact on the source system itself.
Yeah, and also by moving your data through these layers, you know, be it the Medallion architecture or however you want to call it, using the appropriate tool to perform those data transformations and making it visible to the appropriate people as well. So you're not overwhelming business users who really only need to see the end set of tables with a whole bunch of effectively staging tables as part of ETL. So you're right, if it's done well, then what we should hopefully end up with at the end of that process is a series of nice fact and dimension tables ready for self-service or canned users to build their models. And I mean, that's going to still be realistically another area for data to be duplicated into.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But with Direct Lake, you know, we very much view it as a like a caching as opposed to an out and out duplication, simply because we can page the data in and evict it so quickly you know, you're realistically not having to manage like another ETL process. It happens automatically for you, and you can make good use of your SKU memory, ideally.
Mm-hmm. Does it then have a big impact on the size of what you can achieve?
Well, you can do more with less. So,
I mean, which I presume the storage is going to be way less constrained than the memory that you have available in system.
Yeah, well, storage should be cheaper. So you should be able to say, you know, terabytes and much larger amounts of data in your lake houses and in your Delta Lake tables. But this is also one of the beauties of Direct Lake, is the ability to page individual columns and evict individual columns. Means that where previously, if you had 50 gig of data that you wanted to model, you had to have at least a SKU that could cope with 50 gig or more, probably double. Whereas now, potentially, you could even have a 25 gig model and page data in as needed. There'll be challenges with that. But you get that extra flexibility if those sort of constraints are something you want to have to not to worry about.
And listen, they also talk about similar performance to import mode when you're using Direct Lake mode. What's the reality you're finding at the moment in terms of how similar is that word similar?
Okay. So generally with BI models, you're interested in three things. How big is the model going to be when data is at rest? How long does it take for me to get data into that model? And query speed. So your last question is probably focusing on the last part of that, which is query speed. So the assumption is when data has been paged into memory, and it's fully what we would call warm cache, so it's good to go. How does that compare with import? Now, theoretically, that should be practically the same, but there are some things that can make a difference there, such as if you've got too much data, then what will actually happen is we'll fall back to SQL. So there are some guardrails in place which mean we won't use Direct Lake necessarily, we'll fall back to SQL. But there are also some subtle nuance type issues as well, like such as there's a property where you can enable or disable this fallback to SQL, because if you fall back to SQL, you effectively go into direct query mode.
Yep. Yeah. So it's not like you're then changing to an import mode or something. You're talking about, instead of having this, you're then falling back to let's go and run direct query.
And what's important is, even if we don't necessarily fall back to DQ, just because we potentially might need to, we can come up with different query plans. We have to be a little bit more conservative about the physical and logical plan, just in case. Now, the query might not need to, might still fully execute on the paged in data. So that can have an impact. And that's something that you can actually turn off. So you could say, I don't want to fall back to SQL. And what that might mean on the same model is you now potentially might start generating more efficient query plans. This is really getting down into the dirty, but another important area is actually the how the data gets laid out. Because with import, what happens is you generally perform a refresh, which connects mm-hmm. to a data source and a wide variety of data sources. And let's say you're going to bring in a billion rows of data. It might stream the data in, and every 8 million rows or so will stop, pause, and we'll take that batch of data and compress it into a what we call a segment.
A new segment.
That's right. Yeah. And you end up at the end of the import process with a whole bunch of segments, which are nice 8 million row blocks. Now, when you're bringing data in, you might have sorted your data in a particular way, such as chronologically by date. And that means that the way the data is organized across those segments can therefore have an impact on the query speed. So in the in the Delta Lake equivalent, your data is obviously spread across Parquet files, and internally within each Parquet file there's a concept of a row group. Now, row group maps one-to-one with a segment, and you might have your data sort of randomized spread in a Delta Lake table, whereas it's perhaps sorted. Yeah. And if your query hits a sweet spot, like you say, I just want to sum a particular column for these given dates, you know, 2 years ago. And on both the import and the Direct Lake model, what will happen is every single segment gets opened and scanned, and regardless, you know, there's no segment elimination logic on either side. However, if your filter is on a column which is really low, like one value in that entire segment, it can effectively process the segment super quickly because it can skip massively. Like
in the header, it immediately knows what's going
on.
It can pretty much
process however many segments there are in next to no time. And then, you know, when it does hit a segment where it does have the data, then it can spend a little bit of time there. So you can actually have a Direct Lake model slower by, say, 2x than what looks like an equivalent sized import model. But equally, you can, if you want to, organize your data the way it's laid out in the Delta Lake to optimize for a query. Now, you have to be very careful not to overfit, but I could also show you a query running on a Direct Lake data set that is 5 times faster than the equivalent import if it just so happens that the query filters, etc., can scan through the segments so much faster because of the data skews. Now, you do have to be careful because, like I say, you can get one individual query running much faster, but then holistically, all of your generic queries that are grouping and filtering on a bunch of different things might be slower. So it's a bit of an it's a bit of an art. It's interesting. I find it fascinating. And these are the sort of things that I'm looking at because we've got some very large customers with a lot of capacity that they need a lot of compute, and therefore potentially need to spend a lot of money on buying fabric capacities. So if they can shave off a quarter of their capacities and still present and, you know, provide the same reporting capability, you know, it's can be well worth the exercise of diving down into these kinds of techniques that you can do. So getting back to your original, how does Direct Lake compare with import? The theory is, yes, they should be quite similar once they're warm cached in, and that's what we would expect to see. However, there might be some things like I just discussed. There are actually still one or two things we need to add to Direct Lake as well in terms of optimizations you might get when you run a query in import mode that you don't quite hit on Direct Lake.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com. What about the normal Databricks stuff like vOrder optimization, Z or Z order optimization, the optimize for, you know, removing, you know, like a whole lot of little files as opposed to bigger files and so on?
VORDER's huge. VORDER's definitely something you want to make sure you will get not only faster paging performance, but also faster query speed, simply because of the extra compression. Unlike other technical domains, when you aggressively compress something, you have to aggressively uncompress it, which takes time before you can get the data. But analysis services can not only read compressed data, it loves it. The more compression you can perform on your data, the better your paging speed and your query speed will be. However, it will come at a cost that it will take longer to write that. And it's definitely something you want to have a look at. So vOrder on will take longer, but to produce the file, to write the delta, but be faster to bring in. Defragmentation, every data modification operation that takes place on a delta table generates at least one new Parquet file, potentially multiple, depending on how that's going about. So,
and log entries.
If you start to append and accumulate many, many more Parquet files in the underlying lakehouse and in the delta table, then when it comes time to page in that can therefore generate a lot more I/O. So there are things you can do to optimize. There is an optimize command that can help defrag or consolidate, say, you know, a whole variety, a lot of Parquet files down to a smaller group, which will help speed up paging data in.
I wonder, is there some sort of sweet spot, though, that, because I'm thinking about what you were talking about before. So, I mean, for example, if I had a lot of Parquet files, then the thing is I've got to check at least the header of stuff for each one of those to know if any of the rows are of interest when I'm running a query. And so I could reduce that by having much bigger files. But conversely, if I have much bigger files, the chance of having to read the file becomes more likely. And so you just sort of wonder if there's a sort of a balance there somewhere.
Definitely. Now, in most cases, you probably don't have to worry about it. We sort of have done our testing. We think we have about right. So when you are generating your Delta Lake tables, you're using Spark, our Fabric Spark, and we've tuned that to sort of say what we think the number of rows per row group and the number of row groups per Parquet file should be, so that it's not something you have to worry about. However, if you do want to roll up your sleeves and tinker and maybe try and find whether that sweet spot is higher or lower than what we're generating, then absolutely you can get in and start adjusting those. You can introduce things like column partitioning. You can use zOrder as well, so you can apply zOrder on top of vOrder, which can bring sorting. That probably isn't going to make too much difference to an analysis services report, but it's there. And the great thing is, you know what, this is a wonderful thing, is that it's still not proprietary. Even when you do have that vOrder applied, you could take those Parquet files, copy them out using your OneLake Explorer, and open and run a query using a non-Microsoft BI tool, run a query, and it, not only will it run and succeed and should produce the correct value, will probably do it faster than if it had actually generated the same Parquet files itself. Because we've got that vOrder, which is which I quite like from a technical purist point of view. Hopefully not too many people think they need to do that, because we've hopefully got the right tools for them to want to keep it in Fabric. But you know what I mean.
Listen, the final thing I'd love to just hear your thoughts on is just where we're at with compatibility and so on. Because, of course, introducing a different storage format where there's standards-based storage under the covers with its own, you know, the set of standard Parquet data types and the funkiness they do with column naming and all these things. All of a sudden, you have to fit in with those things. And what does that mean in terms of compatibility with what we already were using?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question. So compatibility in terms of...
Well, if we start with, say, data types, I look at the list of standard data types in Parquet and I go, is that it? You know what I mean? Like, and actually where it horrifies me a bit more is where, you know, I look at SQL Server basically being implemented over Parquet files and I go, interesting. Like, we've got a rich set of data types. That's not what it looks like. So it means that there has to be some sort of translation going on there, you know, as to how that's going to be stored.
Yeah, so I think that does happen. So the really common data mm-hmm. types, like, you know, whole numbers, decimal numbers, they're pretty straightforward.
Actually, decimals, one of my pet dislikes in Power BI today is that because decimal's actually a float, right? And we don't really have a decimal because it's fine if you use currency, numbers add up okay, because it kind of does that. But I have lots of customers who have decimal values they expect to add up, and of course they don't, you know, because they're approximations. And if I could change anything with a magic wand about Power BI today, I'd have a proper decimal data type.
Yeah, so. And you do have to be careful with this too, because cardinality does have a big impact on not only the paging in speed, but also the query speed.
Oh, so, totally.
So yeah, that's why being able to limit the
number one thing we're doing with optimizing models is reducing cardinality all over the place. Yeah.
And that is something I have bumped into quite a bit with customers saying, hey, you know, we're doing some testing. It's not running as fast as we would like. And when we sort of have a look and go, okay, do you really need this column to 15 decimal places? You know, somewhere upstream, it's probably done some crazy division. And, you know, you do have a lot of very unique values in here. And that therefore causes the paging logic to do a lot more work. So sometimes simplifying it down to, you know, just four decimal places, like you say.
My issue is that if, for example, I want to store 0.1, I can't store 0.1. You know, it's going to store approximately 0.1, you know, and because you can't represent 0.1 in binary, and that's the problem with a float, right, and so on, you know, because it becomes a recurring fraction, like we have recurring fractions in our own numbers that we work with. And so this is the sort of thing where if I look at I often have I've got an article where I talk about number one newbie mistakes using SQL Server, and it's where people use float all the time for storing things like money.
Well, I actually think in our case, what we would do is with 0.1, if we know the data type for the column is to four decimal places, we'll just shift it four positions and we'll store it, I say, as it will look like 1,000. That's how it gets stored, as a whole number 1,000. And then we know at the end, we can kind of cosmetically just shift the number, the decimal point four spots to give you the accurate, the result. But I'm not actually super expert in that area, so I'm just guessing.
Yeah, no, it's I could always sort of tell in SQL Server land, you can see applications where people have used, or just applications in general, you know, when people have used float because they have columns of numbers that just don't quite add up, you know, and so on and so on. But in general, the data types that we had before with analysis services,
I think they mostly met.
Because it says in the data lake doco, it always says some data types are not supported, and I just sort of wondered how restricted.
I think it's like off the top of my head, I think there's some geography type data types that are challenging.
Yeah, that's one that on the import and stuff, I do not understand what they've done there, actually. So the like, if you try and ingest it, if you have a geometry or geography data types, it actually goes through the motions, but then it blows up at the end because it says it's not a supported data type. What I've never understood is why they don't just call toString. You know, if it's a SQL CLR type, why they don't just call toString and then stick the well-known text into the column instead of trying to stick the binary value in the column.
And this probably comes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, user voice and feedback from customers. The reality is we probably just haven't had enough people bump into this, get blocked on it, it's just probably got a bit lost underneath all of the other things that people are asking for. So maybe one day.
It's just if you take the standard sample SQL Server databases and you try and import them, you'll find these problems immediately. Which is amazing. So, but anyway, that is one I've discussed. But the in terms of there was also, I mean, I think there's limitations on like lengths of strings and things, but I always think, like, you know, why on earth have you got gigantic strings in a semantic model in the first place? You know, it never feels like something I want in there.
Yeah, and with Power BI today, you've got this ability to have import and direct query. So perhaps those big long text strings should stay in direct query mode and only grab them when you need them, because you're not going to be summing them, counting them.
Yeah, if you've got to display something somewhere.
And as of today, if you're using direct lake, the model needs to be 100% direct lake. So that will change. Mm-hmm. You'll have the capability to do more complex, rich type modeling down the track, have probably DQ and direct lake and import possibly in the same model. And that's one of the things you can still do today. There's nothing stopping you in Fabric still using just good old fashioned import or import with DQ, for example.
Yeah, because I think we're still, calculated columns, calculated tables, those sorts of things, I think, are not there yet. But again, calculated columns is something we try and sort of squash out of our semantic models if we can, because again, it just greatly affects processing time and memory and things like that.
Some people love them. They have got their they do have their place, particularly with short self-service, spin up a quick and dirty type model versus I think your proper BI corporate central managed model probably should avoid them. Do it correctly. Roche's maxim, do it as far upstream as possible. I forget the exact text, but
and look, the other reason for that is that I may want to connect Excel or something further upstream, and I don't want columns that appear over there that I look in the further upstream and I go, where did this thing come from?
The reality today, the main reason why calculated columns haven't just appeared is they are complex to implement, particularly on Delta Lake, because currently when you do run a sum over a column grouped or filtered by a different column, we know just to page in those columns. Pretty easy. We know what we need.
Yeah.
We know what to do. But a calculated column can often have very complex logic that sometimes even involves aggregating entire tables and
totally.
So what do you page in when you touch in one of these things? It can go off, and there's a bunch of ways you could solve that.
I could imagine it could just kill you.
Yeah.
I kind of
think maybe if materialized views turn up at some point, that could be the easy way to get that back for those that do like having calculated columns. But it'll evolve. This is still very, very new. Yep. This is a great new technology. It's very exciting. And I do want to emphasize it. If you are using Fabric, you don't have to use direct lake. You can still use the import.
Totally. This is a new option. Yeah. So, hey, one thing I will ask about too is that we tend to generally be bringing in, little batches and so on of rows of data and so on into a model. And one thing I'm sort of nervous about, where you don't have like a specific processing stage, is how do you make consistency? I add order lines, but I don't have an order yet, or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, so on a direct lake model, there's a feature called auto refresh that you can enable. I think it's on by default. So that means any time a data modification operation takes place in the lakehouse, say you're adding order lines, but you haven't quite added the header yet, for example, that change will get immediately reflected. And if someone happens to load a Power BI report at that time, you might get some quite strange results. But you can turn this property off. So you can say, I don't want to have my direct lake semantic model immediately respond as data changes take place. I want to control that. And this is where a concept called framing is introduced with direct lake models. And you kind of get this for free with import as well, because you can control it when you decide to refresh your import model. That's when hopefully your data in your source is consistent at that point. And then when the refresh completes, if your data source gets out of sync, then it doesn't matter, because you've imported the data. Your DAX queries are hitting a consistent view of the data in the tables. But with direct lake, you can turn this property off. And what that means is, as data modification operations take place in the lakehouse, like you add a bunch of order lines, but you don't add the order header, the model is completely oblivious to those changes. It will not see them until you perform a reframe. Now, a reframe on a direct lake model is just a refresh. But a refresh doesn't do anything. It doesn't take hours or half an hour to run or anything. All a reframe does is draw a new line in the sand at that point in time. And it evicts everything from the memory. And what will happen is from that point, as DAX queries come in, that's the consistent the Parquet files up to that point are what I use to page data in. So therefore, if someone does come along and starts adding data to the order line table, they get ignored because it's only at the point of the reframe operation that we will use. And it's the nature of the way.
Yeah, I was just wondering how that worked, because if you've got a model, you know, that's or report that's reading data, and suddenly it reads some data that isn't in memory, then it's going to have to go off. And if the only storage of the data is what's in the Parquet files,
Well, that's what it uses. Because every data,
Does it use the time travel stuff in Parquet? That is what it does. So
because whenever you perform a data modification operation to a delta table, you're always adding a new Parquet file. Even if you're performing a delete operation, you're not going away, not going back and changing the contents of any of the previous Parquet files. You're just adding a new file. So what we can do is we can ignore files after that point.
The log files actually have details of exactly what happened at what time. So it does give you that ability to do time travel. I did wonder if that's what they're doing, because that's what I felt I needed, was the ability to say, look, stop, stop for a minute. This is the point at which I want you to do the reporting. And then, it's okay to continue on again.
So for example, if you've got a delta table that has 20 Parquet files, and this is the outcome of a whole bunch of inserts and updates, etc. Okay, and you reframe at that point, then, your data gets paged into the semantic model based on data in those 20 Parquet files. Now, if someone comes along and performs a delete, just deletes everything, what will happen is you'll get a 21st file. Now, if I now query that in Spark or SQL, go select star from that table, I'll get no rows, because it's, unless I'm specifically asking for the time travel. So even if your semantic model gets evicted from the node, because we do load balancing, if even it gets completely evicted from a node and gets loaded into another node and all the columns are empty and a DAX query comes in, it'll use those original 20 files to determine what should populate that table.
Yeah, what it looked like
exactly
at that time.
Ignore the 21st file, which has that delete instruction, until you go and reframe. I'm happy, or my Lakehouse tables are consistent, I'm going to perform a reframe operation, and then the semantic model will now reflect that. So that's how we... And as I mentioned, you kind of get that today with import, because you control the time. You just kick off your import process.
Exactly.
So that's what DirectLake does. It's called reframing, and it's quite interesting. And it's important, especially for those larger BI teams.
Oh, yeah. So super, super important. Yeah, because otherwise you could end up with things that are inconsistent.
Well, if you've got someone trying
place.
To load a report in the middle of an ETL operation, who knows what state the tables are in. So
that's right. And particularly if you're doing it sort of quite incrementally, you could end up with things that are in weird states. So that's good. Hey, listen, that pretty much brings us to time, though, Phil. What have you got coming up? Where will people see you, or what's happening?
Well, next Friday I'm off to SQL Bits. So I'm really excited about that. I haven't been.
You should be. If I could be anywhere, then that's where I'd be.
So I've never been to SQL Bits, and I've only ever heard good things about it. I gather it's won a lot of awards, very, very popular. So I'm looking forward. I've got three sessions there.
Yeah, it's the best data conference going.
So I've got a couple of sessions on DirectLake, and I'm also doing one on a really super deep dive on advanced DAX fusion optimizing. And then from there, I'm really lucky that I'm going to be heading to Las Vegas for the Fabric conference.
For the Fabric conference, exactly.
So I'll be doing a couple of sessions there along with a workshop. And then a little later, about a week after that, we're going to be whizzing around a bunch of Australia and New Zealand cities doing a roadshow. So we'll be calling into the user groups in Auckland, Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. And I'm bringing my good friend Patrick LeBlanc, guy on a Cube fame. He's going to be...
I know Patrick. Yes, I have met him many, many years ago before his fame.
Yep. So please, if you're listening to that,
particularly with Guy and Acute,
please, if you're in one of those cities and you're listening here, you know, come along and meet him in person and get your fabric questions answered.
Anyone who's watched Guy and Acute would know. Yeah, Patrick's just he's a bunch of fun.
Yeah, no, definitely good fun. So that's what's happening in the next little while. But internally, I'm also working on documents for Direct Lake that we're trying to get up on the Microsoft Learn site. And so it's a good time. Good time to be involved. And
no, it's busy time. Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, listen, so thank you so very much for your time.
No worries. Thanks for inviting me. And cheers. Bye-bye.
All good.